Marie Bernard, host of Synchronicity, Friday mornings at 9. Join me as we explore topics like health and wellness, prosperity, inner peace, the law of attraction, and more. Tap into good vibrations to start your weekend feeling uplifted and optimistic. Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. Fridays from 9 to 10 a.m. on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Good morning. Welcome to Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie, and today we have Robert Cull. He is the author of a wonderful book, Solitude, Seeking Wisdom in Extremes. And we will be on in just a moment. We're having some technical difficulties here. So, yes, welcome to the show, Bob Cull. Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. How are you today?
I'm wonderful. So today, are you in Vancouver right now?
I am in Vancouver, yes.
Oh, are you getting excited for the Olympics?
No. No, I'm not an Olympics fan.
No.
I mean, I think the sports are great, but I think it's just been a real scam for normal people. And, you know, taxpayers are going to be stuck with huge bills and stuff like that.
So. Oh, that's definitely, I wouldn't disagree with that, for sure. Okay, well, let's get on with the show. So you are the author of Solitude, Seeking Wisdom in Extremes, and you actually earned your PhD here from UBC.
Yes.
Wonderful. So let's talk a little bit about your background. In February 2001, you traveled to a remote island in the Chilean wilderness with enough supplies to live alone for a year, and you wrote a book about it, and there's a lot of stuff that goes on in the book. So what do you think that you were hoping to accomplish on the trip, and do you feel that you did accomplish it?
I was going to get enlightened. I went to fix my life. I went to solve all the, you know, answer all the questions of the universe and all those things that were taught are possible, and that I was going to find some permanent end state that I would just live blissed out and forever and ever. And did I find it? I think I found something that I wasn't looking for, in that it struck me after time that this notion that we have in the West of enlightenment is really illusory, that it's a dream that's in some sense been foisted on us by marketeers, that it seems to me that we live our lives and reaching out to get something that's called enlightenment is the wrong direction. It's a conceptual notion, this idea of a thing called enlightenment. And that, in fact, what I discovered was radically in the other direction, is letting go of that notion of enlightenment and coming into the present and living life in all its ups and downs. And that discovery comes and goes, like all else, that there are times when I'm really relaxed and flowing with the moment, and other times not. And when I'm not, there are times that I can accept that I'm not, and other times when I can't accept I'm not. So everything seems to be in a state of fluidity and flux. And the process for me is just learning to be with all of it, everything that's coming and going, and the stuff I like, the stuff I don't like. And so that's not, of course, a new discovery. That's what spiritual teachers have been saying for a long time. But I think we've gotten confused in the West with this notion of getting. You know, we have this avarice in the West, and it's taken over spiritual practice largely, too. And so coming and also knowing these things intellectually and little by little, internalizing them so they become part of our being are very different things. And so it's just an ongoing process of discovery, exploration, discovery.
So, Bob, on your first extended period of solitude in the wilderness, you reached a point where you felt that your life was forever healed, and that's kind of what we're talking about, this enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
And then you discovered that the feeling was transient. But why do you think these moments of clarity that and connectedness that we're able to achieve just float away so easily?
Well, I don't know, and I'm not even beginning to say that some people don't achieve permanent states like this. I don't know that. That's not for me to say. I know that I haven't, and nobody I know has. Even people that are known for, you know, being spiritual masters, they all seem to come and go. There's different ways of looking at it, I think. One thing that I've discovered while I was in solitude, one of the wonders of long solitude, like a long meditation retreat, is that there's the space to discover that what we often project out onto the world as reasons for our experience are largely just that, they're projections. And so these inner movements seem to me to just be inner rhythms of the world. And I came to use the notion of inner weather as a metaphor for what I was experiencing on all different levels of the inward world, the inward life. And in the same way, you know, we know here in Vancouver that weather happens. You know, if you live in sunny Southern California, you can believe that it should be sunny all the time. But here we know that's not the case. And if we rebel against and reject weather, rain, and storms, we live a miserable life here. And so our challenge is not to try to make it sunny all the time, but to learn to appreciate and engage with all the different weather patterns and really live fully in all these different climatic states. And I think the same is so inside, at least for me, that there are storms that roll through, darknesses and confusions. And we have this fantasy that somehow we can just live in this bliss of clarity and ecstasy all the time. And I think that we can live in a place of joy, of being with all these different inner states as being a natural part of what it means to be human. But it's just a fantasy to think it's always going to be sunny and clear inwardly. Part of that strikes me as well as, and I don't understand why this is, but I see in myself a willful turning away, that I'll struggle and struggle for inner clarity, and then in the moments of release, shortly thereafter, I can actually feel myself inwardly turning away from that. And it's really strange. It's like, wow, why did I just turn away from this when I struggled so long for this freedom? And then once it's there, it's almost like I'm bored, or let's get on, let's go do something else now. So it's quite a strange inner movement, and I'm not clear exactly what it is, but I suspect it's just part of the ongoing desire for more, instead of simply allowing to whatever it is. And in that wanting more, whether it's wanting more of that state, that takes me out of the flow of the moment. And in that desire that experience continue, that desire in itself pulls me out of that experience. And so there's a variety of different ways of looking at and talking about this shift back out of that state of flowing wonder.
Now, Bob, you were very affected by the weather. Your mood and how you felt seemed to be really closely connected with what the weather was like outside. Mm-hmm. That inner storm. And I'm curious, do you feel like your solitude made you physically more intuitive? Like when there was that huge tsunami a few years ago, reports have been made that the animals had fled to higher places because something in them sensed that this tsunami was coming. Do you think if there had been some kind of disaster like that, that maybe you would have been able to tune into it?
That's a really good question. Probably not. One of my incredible frustrations where I was is that I didn't seem to be able to predict the weather. And it was a significant issue for me because I was spending time in a small inflatable boat on the sea. I'd always go for all my firewood by boat, and I went fishing by boat. And I took a couple of long trips, one quite long, about 300 miles round trip, in this small boat. And so the area I was is one of the stormiest places on Earth. It's just hugely windy down on the tip of South America. I was way down, almost to the very tip of South America, and it's the roaring 40s, 50s. And the wind comes whistling around the Earth, and there's no other landmass down there except Australia, New Zealand. And the wind just smashes up against the Andes and the Pacific coast. And it can be sunny and calm, and within half an hour, it's just a roaring storm. And I had a barometer, but it didn't seem to be linked with what the weather was doing. And so as the months went by, and I'd make plans to go on a trip or to go off and get firewood, and I'd be all ready to go, and then the ocean would just fall apart. A storm would roll in and created huge amounts of anxiety for me, constantly imagining that I would be out there. I was already in the middle of nowhere with no help around, and that I'd be another 50, 60, 70 miles from camp out there, trapped by a storm or the outboard motor, which I was having problems with because a storm flipped the boat one night and drowned my outboard motors in the sea. I got them working, but they were never quite right. And so there was this enormous anxiety of being at the mercy of the weather. And the wind became a malevolent presence early on, something that was out to get me, intent on my annihilation. And it was a metaphor of existential angst, our sense of impermanence in the face of an enormous, uncaring universe. So there was that whole anxiety around that issue of weather. And I always had the sense of being vulnerable because I couldn't predict it, and it infuriated me over and over. When my friend Patty came to stay a month on the island after I'd been there a year, she helped me with the transition of coming back into the world of people. Her experience was, she said, that I could predict the weather, that I did have a sense of the weather. So I guess, you know, from her perspective, I had a feel for it. From my own, I felt that it was just mysterious, and I couldn't predict it. So it's hard to know how well I was, you know, how much in tune I was. There were definitely times, though, that I felt that I was in tune with it when I was doing some delicate work outside that I couldn't get wet, and I would just finish over and over and get back inside before the rain would come again. And so, you know, one of the things in solitude, there's nobody to bounce stuff off, and so it's difficult to know the perception. Somebody said, you know, weren't you worried about going crazy? And I said, well, how would I know? You know, they said, well, did you see hallucinations? Did you hallucinate? Did you see visions? And I go, how would I know? You know, I have my experience, and whether stuff is real or hallucinatory, you can't really tell in some sense. And there is, you can explore inwardly from previous experience and contextualize it and recognize, oh yeah, like projection, go, yeah, look, I'm projecting that, but it's all based on other inner experience and comparing, because there's nobody else around to say, hey, are you seeing what I'm seeing, kind of a thing.
Well, we are talking with Bob Cull. He is the author of Solitude, Seeking Wisdom in Extremes. If you'd like to get on the air and ask him a question, the number is 604-822-2487. That's 604-UBC-CITR. It's time now for a break. We'll be back with more Synchronicity in just a moment.
On Tuesday, February 16th, Scottish-born songwriter David Francie is performing at the Stanley Industrial Alliance stage at 2750 Granville. In concert, David is a singer and a storyteller. His wry humor and astute observations combined with his open-hearted singing style have earned him a loyal following. David Francie has released 8 crafted albums, earning him 3 Junos and the SoCan Folk Music Award. Touring with David is American ballad maker and multi-instrumentalist Craig Worth. Don't miss out on this chance to see one of Canada's finest songwriters. David Francie, Tuesday, February 16th at the Stanley Industrial Alliance stage at 2750 Granville. Tickets are available at vancouvertix.com.
Welcome back to Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie, and today we're speaking with Robert Kull. He is the author of Solitude, Seeking Wisdom in Extremes. Welcome back to the show, Robert.
Thank you.
Do you prefer Robert or Bob?
Oh, I don't care.
Okay.
but I usually go by Bob, but I don't really care.
Okay. So in the beginning of your book, you mention how you had the inner light almost flicked out. That's the word that you, the term that you used, mm-hmm. while you were living the party lifestyle in the Caribbean. And then you had an accident where you lost your foot. Mm-hmm. And what was it that changed in you when that happened?
You know, there's kind of, for me, there's different aspects of who I am, and at different times, I tend to be pretty extreme in the way I live, and so I'll get very focused and intent on one aspect of what I'm up to. And so when I was in the Caribbean, I was living, as you say, the party life, involved with lots of tourist women, and also scuba diving. I was teaching scuba diving, and so my love affair with the ocean was just all-consuming in some ways. And when that came to a sudden halt with a motorcycle crash, I was off to scuba dive with the whales on my day off, because even on my days off, I'd live in the ocean. I just want to spend time under the water. And so there was this radical shift from this sense of wild freedom to kind of doing what I wanted to do, riding my motorcycle and scuba diving, to be flat on my back in a hospital. I got flown to Montreal and spent most of a year in a hospital, my leg up in traction, and multiple surgeries trying to save the foot, and it just didn't work. And the whole thing of body image, having to let go of this sexy scuba instructor image of being really fit and all those things. So there was this enormous having to surrender an identity, because I was really identified with my body, with my physicality. And I remember, and this was a process that went on and on. They'd think, oh, yeah, you know, this is looking good after one of the microsurgeries and the foot, we're going to save it. And then it would get infected again, and no, it's not going to work. And they do another surgery. So there was this incredible roller coaster for month after month. And in the background, I had this inner vision that I was going to be a cripple, and you know, this horrific sense of what was going on, and I was losing it all. And so just having to face that, and one day I was out behind the hospital in the wheelchair, it was summer, and I was out reading the Chuang Tzu, which is a book I carried forever. It was one of the two books I took into my first long wilderness retreat here in British Columbia, the I Ching and Chuang Tzu, and there's a passage in there about these two mystics talking with each other about the flow of life and letting go and simply allowing themselves to be in the moment with however it was. And there was just this incredible sense of relief of letting go of my expectations and my preconceptions of how life should be, and saying, okay, this is how it is. It's not about getting it how I want it to be. It's about learning to live in joy with how things actually are. So that was a fundamental shift. And then I couldn't, you know, my physicality was really different for quite a while. I couldn't walk, and so I started my undergraduate university at 40. And that was a whole nother thing of shifting domains from being really physical into being intellectual. Excuse me. But during that, the 5 years of undergraduate, I did two degrees. Something happened, and I wasn't sure what was going on, but I really felt dead. And it wasn't until I went off and spent a couple of months by myself in northern Quebec after I graduated that the world came alive again. And I realized that what had happened in the university was that my sense of connection with myself and with the non-human world, this feeling of being alive in the world and that the world was alive, had essentially disappeared for me, and that I was living in just a conceptual world of facts and theories in the academic life. And so I went traveling again for a couple of years and then ended up at UBC working on a PhD. And my bottom line was that I wasn't going to check myself at the door anymore, that it seemed to me and still seems to me that one of the basics of education is our own lived experience. What matters most to us as human beings is not really welcomed into the process. And so when I started my PhD in negotiation with my research committee, it's like anything's up for grabs for negotiation, but I am going to spend a year alone in the wilderness, and I will bring all aspects of myself into this process, my heart and my mind and the emotions and spiritual realizations and questions, that all of that has to find a home within the academic setting. And so it's kind of a long process. It's not a one-off shift that, oh, I had this thing happen and my life changed. These things, there have been a number of these different processes over many years that I come and go, and then I get sidetracked into doing something else and get called back to that inner light. And so it's kind of, there's natural rhythms and cycles, and then if I get distracted and so focused on external events of my life, then I tend to lose track of that inner light.
And Bob, when you were out in the wilderness, there were times when your prosthetic foot, is it that you have?
Prosthetic leg, yeah. Prosthetic leg. Amputation below the knee.
So it sounds like there were some problems that arose from that, because you were having to climb over slippery rocks and things like that. So how were you able to deal with the challenge? Did you ever find yourself feeling resentment for the situation you were in?
I felt resentment for pain. Not around the prosthetic leg, but just that there's so much pain in my life. There were times when the phantom limb pains would kick in, and then it's just really a kind of a terrifying experience, because it's horrible, and some people really suffer a lot from that. I'm quite fortunate in that they're rare experiences for me and transient, but it feels for me like somebody's stabbing a knife in my foot that doesn't exist anymore, or burning it, and so it's really unpleasant. And because of my leg and lack of balance, the rocks were slippery. I fell several times and tore up the rotator cuffs in both shoulders. I'd torn up one some years previously, and so it retore. And so there was just month after month of a lot of pain. And there were definitely times when I was angry and resentful about the physical pain of my life. And so there would be wonder and joy, and then the pain would kick in again, especially at night. And, the sense of having no grace in the face of this pain. There was definitely that, and that was a huge thing of coming, of part of this process of learning to be with what actually is. You know, I didn't choose the pain, but the pain was, and the pain continues in my life, and learning to relax into it, because it's resistance to pain that amplifies and makes it worse than it needs to be. And that sense of why me? How come I'm being singled out for this? And I think that a huge part of our development as human beings is to stop taking things so personally and recognize, no, everybody has pain. That's part of living. If we want the tenderness and the sensitivity to the wonders of life, it includes experiences of pain. And for me, I'm still a wuss. I hate pain. But it just seems like the things that call to me to live fully always involve some level of pain. And if I'm not willing to experience fear and pain, then I my life tends to get narrow and shallow.
And Bob, when you were out there battling with this pain, and it sounded like throughout the book, I mean, especially with your shoulder injuries, and you were having to, you know, construct a shelter and all of that through dealing with this incredible shoulder pain. I mean, wasn't there ever a time that you just felt like you wanted to call or email and say to your friends, come and rescue me?
Not really. If I had been younger, maybe. But I'm stubborn. And so it's not even that I decide that I'm going to stick this out. It's just it doesn't quite occur to me to bail on it. It's just like, well, this is what I'm doing now. But more than that, there were definitely times when I didn't want to be there. I just didn't want to be there. And that blew my mind. I thought, God, you know, look at all the energy and time and effort I've put into getting here. And now I don't want to be here? What are you, nuts? But the thing is that I've been through enough different things in my life and lived enough different places that when those times of not wanting to be here arise, I recognize that there's no place else that I want to be either. That no matter where I was, I mean, there might be a short window of yeah, this is cool, because new stuff is always cool. But there's this recognition that that mindset of I don't want to be here is something that goes with me. And so no matter the situation, that arises in my mind. And so it's recognizing I need to deal with this, live with this experience of not wanting to be here, wherever it arises. Moving and changing my external circumstances is not going to solve that. It's an inner state of mind that I need to learn to be with. And in that being with it, there's a transformation. Instead of trying to escape that feeling, if I allow myself to experience it to settle into it without getting swept away, but finding that equanimity, that feeling can transform into wonder and joy. And that's my sense of a lot of inner difficult states of mind, whether it's anger or frustration or anxiety, that if I, instead of, one of the things in solitude, it's a real opportunity and a challenge, is there's nobody to lean on. There's no way to escape this stuff. And so you sooner or later need to simply allow yourself to experience all these inner states, these dark states. But at the same time, there's a real risk if you allow yourself to get swept away. There's, again, nobody to lean on. And so there's the challenge of experiencing all these different states fully without being swept away, of finding that middle ground of inner balance. And in that, there for me, that's where freedom lies, is the willingness to experience all of it without clinging and without rejecting and without getting swept away.
Wonderful. Thank you. Well, it's time now for another break. We are speaking with Robert Kull. He is the author of Solitude, Seeking Wisdom in Extremes. He spent a year in solitude in the Chilean wilderness and had some adventures and misadventures. If you want to call in and get on the air and ask him a question, the number is 604-822-2487. That's 604-UBC-CITR. We'll be back with more Synchronicity in just a moment.
Rude boys, don't cry, don't cry.
Rude boy, don't cry.
Roses, ska music, you make me dance all night.
Ska music, you're alright.
Scenic Drive, every Friday morning, 10 a.m. till noon, CITR.
One, two!
Hey, I'm Wayne Dyer, and you're listening to Synchronicity with Marie Bernard. Here she is.
Hi, welcome back to Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. I wanted to let you know I'm starting a new radio show for Namaste Publishing, and that will be online only. It'll be on blogtalkradio.com/Namaste Radio. That starts on Tuesday, February 16th. It'll be Tuesday evenings at 7 o'clock Pacific time, 7 p.m. Pacific time on Blog Talk Radio. You can find out more information about all of the shows that I'm involved with at spiritualshow.com. And there's lots of information about everything that's coming up. Again, if you want to get on the air and ask Bob Kull a question, the number is 604-822-2487. That's 604-UBC-CITR. The topic of today's show is solitude and his book, Solitude, Seeking Wisdom in Extremes. Welcome back, Bob.
Thank you.
Hi. So we were talking before the break about the feelings of I don't want to be here, the feelings of not being able to accept the way your life is, and the necessity of needing to be able to accept where you are and find peace and joy no matter how your life is, no matter what challenges there are. But how did you get to that point? Because I can imagine with no one around to reel you in, it could have been pretty easy to spiral down into despair.
Yeah, it was easy, and I did. You know, sure. It's just that's part of the process. One of the, you know, I don't know. Maybe I'm just odd, but I read and hear spiritual teachers talking about the spiritual journey as though it's kind of a linear path. You know, there are these three rules to success. You do this, you do this, you do this, and you'll be fixed. And that's just not been my experience. It may be the experience of other people, but I try to base what I say on my actual experience and not mythologize it, not make it any better or different than it actually is. And for me, the spiritual journey is mysterious. It's like a kid learning to walk. You know, you crawl and then you stand up and then you fall down and then you crawl and then you stand up and walk and then you fall down. Or it's like learning to dance, that some, you know, you can learn the basic steps. You can have a teacher that teaches you these are the basic steps. But sooner or later, you need to let go of all that and just go down into yourself and feel your own individual inner rhythms and allow yourself to move spontaneously with the music. And it's risky. It's not an easy process. The spiritual journey is not an easy process. There, as far as I can tell, there are no shortcuts. You don't get to touch the hem of somebody's robe and be fixed. That's, you know, just not how it works. And one of the things that I found incredibly frustrating in solitude was this sense, well, I'm doing everything I'm supposed to be doing, and life still sucks. I still am angry. I'm still caught up. And every time I try to let go, knowing that the process is one of surrender, of surrendering my expectations, of surrendering my desires, and just allowing myself to experience what is, knowing that that's the key, and trying to do that, it still wasn't working. And little by little, I came to recognize this catch-22, and it's almost like a cosmic joke, that the very act of attempting to develop spiritually, to attempt to let go, is what holds us trapped in the ego, in this sense of this small I. And so there, the moments of surrender seem mysterious to me, that I come to a place where I try everything I know how to try and it doesn't work and I'm still tangled up in a knot and there's still this feeling of alienation. And then there's a moment of release. There's this slip from small, tangled up mind into the big flowing mind of being woven into the universe. And it's like, wow, how did that just happen? And what I went to do was learn to control that shift. And I never figured it out. I thought, I'll learn to control it, and then I can come and teach other people to control it. And so there was a sense of failure and disappointment. And little by little, one of the aphorisms is this notion of life is a mystery to be lived, not a problem to be solved. And I just think that that's a beautiful statement. And so I'm out there, and I'm going, okay, so the problem I have to solve is how to shift from living life as a problem to living life as a mystery. And then, you know, it took me quite a while to start laughing at myself and going, oh, right, that's another problem to be solved that I have to let go of. The transformation from living life as a problem to be solved to living it as a mystery to be lived is also a mystery to be lived. That transformation is a mystery. How that happens is mysterious. And that, too, is part of the surrender to going, okay, I don't control this shift. I live in it. And sometimes it happens, and sometimes it doesn't. And then the Zen statement that enlightenment is an accident, and all that spiritual practice can do is make us accident prone, it starts to make really good sense. It's, oh, you know, I can't control this shift. However, if I don't work towards it, and working towards it holds me, precludes it, holds me in place, and yet, if I don't work towards it, nothing happens. So there's this catch-22, this circular catch-22. And as far as I can tell, we just keep working with it without any specific rules. And there are certain things we can do, practices, stay present in the moment, and be with ourselves. And those moments of release happen, and they happen more frequently. And so in some sense, it's like learning to play the piano or ride a bicycle or anything. There are no conceptual rules of how to do it. But there is practice, and as we practice, we get better at it, and the moments of release become more frequent, and the moments when we're tangled up aren't so, they're not so intense, they're not so frequent or intense, and so there's this kind of experiential exploration of this transition. And so for me, excuse me, it's just doing it over and over of walking that path between these different inner states, and in crossing that boundary over and over inwardly, the boundary becomes more porous and more accessible. And part of what I attempted in the book is coming back. You know, this was a tricky thing as doing this as a PhD dissertation, is you're supposed to go and ask a question and get an answer and come back with the answer. And I came back going, well, I don't know any answers. How am I going to turn that into a PhD? And so it's the recognition that the answers are experiential rather than conceptual. And so the book, in some ways, is a guided meditation of just readers going through this daily experience of these different shifts from, you know, being uptight to being woven into the universe to being uptight, and just following that shift over and over with me through the experience. So readers actually experience that transformation in themselves, and it becomes more familiar territory to people reading the book in their own lives, because the book's not primarily about my life, it's about the reader's life and exploring and reflecting on their own lives.
Well, it's time already for another break, so we will be back with more Synchronicity in just a moment. This is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You may also be listening online at CITR.ca, CosmicDimensions.com, EmpowerRadio.com, or on the Co-Creator Network. And we'll be back in just a moment.
Ever thought about volunteering with Big Sisters? Maybe now is the time. Big Sisters of BC Lower Mainland provides girls aged 7 to 17 with a champion, a mentor who's there to simply be their friend and cheer them on. Become a study buddy tutor and spend 1 hour a week helping your little sister learn to love school. Or become a big sister and spend 3 fun hours a week just hanging out with your little sister. If you're age 19 or older, please visit bigsisters.bc.ca to find out more. Maybe now is the time.
This is Deepak Chopra. You're listening to Synchronicity.
Welcome back to Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. I am your host, Marie. If you want more information about my show, you can check out spiritualshow.com. We are speaking with Robert Kull. He is the author of Solitude, Seeking Wisdom in Extremes. If you want to get on the air and ask him a question, 604-822-2487. That's 604-UBC-CITR. That's the number to call. Hi, Bob. Welcome back to the show.
Hi.
And your website, bobkull.com.
No, .org.
.org, rather. Bobkull.org. You have pictures up there of some of the things that you experienced?
There's a whole bunch of photographs. There's a video. There's a slideshow. There's just lots of stuff on the website. So people that are interested in having a view of where I was. It's an incredibly beautiful area where I was, just astonishingly beautiful.
So we've been talking this hour about so many of the challenges that you faced in your year of solitude, but you also had, you brought a cat to the island, and you weren't originally preparing to bring a cat, but someone had recommended that if you were going to eat shellfish there, that you should bring a cat to use as a guinea pig.
Right.
And you kind of formed a relationship with this cat, kind of a love-hate relationship, it sounded like. And what were some of the other positive aspects of living out in the wilderness?
Well, for me, the solitude is incredible. Because of the spacious stillness, there's the opportunity for this amazing spacious stillness to develop. I put away my watch and calendar and just lived with the changing of the days, light and dark and tides coming in and leaving and the change of seasons. And different animals would come. They'd be present on the island, hawks and kingfisher hunting, and it appeared to be part of their cycle, you know, where their territorial shifts. There was a pair of flightless steamer ducks that their territory was around the front of this tiny island I was on. And so this feeling of being woven into the universe, of living with this wonder and joy of the non-human world, and not just thinking about it, but actually experiencing myself to be part of it, was just wonderful. And for me, there are times when the whole world comes alive, not just what we think of as living things, but everything, the sky and the rocks and the table in my cabin and myself, you know, this feeling of that the universe is pulsatingly alive and filled with joy and wonder, that there's this presence of spirit, that everything is sacred. And it's that experience that really beckons to me, that shift, because often we live, I do, and I think most people do in our culture, in kind of this mechanistic world that nothing is really vibrantly alive most of the time. We just kind of go through our days. And so that shift, that transformation to the world filled with wonder and light is, for me, just miraculous.
And your relationship with Kat, it seems like you were really able, even though you were there to be in solitude, you kind of had this relationship with the cat, and it seemed like you really gained a lot of wisdom and insight through your reactions to the cat's behavior. Can you talk a little bit about your relationship with the cat and what you felt how you benefited from his being there, and how you maybe feel like he hadn't have been there?
Kat was a challenge. When I go into solitude, I don't take a pet, because one of the joys and freedoms is to just follow your own inner rhythms and the world around without being responsible for anyone else. And so in taking a cat, that relationship changed. And it's, as you said, that the national parks down there, the government officials said that if I wanted to eat any shellfish for survival, that I needed to take a cat, because red tide is prevalent, comes and goes. But it didn't work, because, you know, asking the cat to test the shellfish was kind of like asking your kid to check some old leftovers in the fridge. We became extremely close. It was an amazingly intense relationship, and there were some real problems, because he was very vocal, and I would be trying to meditate or think, and he'd be crying. I'm somewhat allergic to cats, and so I didn't let him in the cabin. He had his own box outside and all insulated, but he'd get lonely at night. I was outside with him all day long, and we were constantly together. No matter how stormy the weather, these are roaring storms, pouring down rain and wind, and he'd be right out there with me. No matter what I was doing, he was right out there with me. And so he always wanted to be around me, and I definitely didn't always want to be around him. So there was this tension. And partly because of the physical and psychological, spiritual pain I was in a lot of the time, I was on edge. And he would be crying, and it would just drive me nuts. And my sister, who's married to a vet, had told me that, you can get a cat to do anything you want. Just throw a little water at him, you know, squirt him with water. But this was a cat, I'm saying, would go out in storms, and so squirting him with water was not having any effect. And he would learn to dodge cups of water, and I was throwing buckets of water at him, and just really behaving towards him out of rage, out of pain and anxiety and rage and behaving in ways that were really demonic in my view. I didn't cause him any physical damage, but I certainly caused him some pain. I would slap him, or I'd be taking photographs of birds, and he'd walk by and scare the birds away that I just spent an hour sneaking up on to get photographs. So there was this incredible tension between us. Most of the time, our relationship was really loving, and there was a lot of joy and sharing, and he spent huge numbers of hours sitting in my lap. You know, I'd be meditating. But there were times when this inner darkness would just come boiling up, and I over and over vowed that I wouldn't interact with him out of anger again, and over I would break that vow. And so it was deeply troubling to me to have to experience this own shadow material in myself behaving badly, and I think I caused myself more pain than I ever caused him. Because we all know, if we're honest with ourselves, that we're capable of dark behavior because we're human beings and given the right circumstances. But that's quite different than actually having to nakedly face this inner darkness as it bubbles up and affects behavior is really painful. It was really a very painful part of the year. But I think that anyone that's serious about their inward journey, sooner or later, has to face the shadow material. It's just part of what it is, and if we're not willing to face that in ourselves, we're kind of stuck on the surface of our being in the socially acceptable persona. So it was a huge gift that Kat gave me. I suspect that I would have had to explore those things anyway if he hadn't been there in some other aspect of the world. My relationship with the wind also brought up really dark material. It was anger and anxiety. And my relationship with both the wind and the cat and the rain, those were my three main teachers. It changed over the years, and I became more and more accepting of those aspects of the world as they are, that I didn't own them. So there was this notion that I owned Cat, and that the Cat should do what I wanted him to do. And little by little, of letting that go and allowing Cat to be who he was in the moment. And then part of that as well is I have this notion, I think many of us do, that we own ourselves, that this little conscious part of our mind owns the whole mind-body process, our emotions, and we should be able to control ourselves. And so letting go of that notion of ownership, of owning myself, of owning the world, and becoming a participant in the dance of life. And Kat was really integral in that transformation. And the wind was too. So over the year, the wind shifted from becoming an adversary intent on my annihilation to being one of my most profound teachers. I would go stand in the roaring winds every day and allow the wind to carve me, and I'd bow to the wind, and then eventually I made a series of kites and hooked them to my fishing rod, and I'd go out in these roaring winds and go sky fishing for the wind. And it was just those relationships really worked on me throughout the year, and Kat was part of that, a really important part of that.
Well, thank you for that. We just have a few minutes left in the show, Bob, so I'm wondering if there's anything you would like to... What was the biggest thing, if you had to say, like, the top one or two things that you carry with you now from your experience of solitude, what would those be?
You know, I don't think I learned anything that hasn't been told a bunch of times. Come into the moment. Learn to live in the minute, you know, in the here and the now, with all the ups and downs, the lights and the darks. Learn to accept ourselves and the world as things are, not as we would like them to be. We are so out of balance in our culture with our desires and aversions of wanting things to be the way we want them to be and not wanting things to be certain ways. But, you know, to live in the wonder of the world, we really need to not like but accept things as they are. And part of that process is relaxing our desires, relaxing our demands for things slowly shaping ourselves to surrendering to the moment as it is. My own ongoing issue is learning to experience the city. I'm living in Vancouver now, and typically we go off into nature because nature is somehow sacred and the city isn't. And that strikes me as kind of the same as going to church. It's a particular building that's sacred to some people. And it seems to me that if spirit exists, it exists everywhere. And so part of my process is learning to experience the city as sacred and alive as well. And my big thing is I just spend a lot of my time grumbling my way through my days unconsciously. And it's learning to find joy in every moment, just day, moment by moment, not look for special occasions, special things, but to come, you know, slow down and become still. Because for me, I've spent so much of my younger life reaching out, seeking experiences and excitement, those special moments that would make my life different and special. And I've learned that what I find most valuable is to sit still wherever I am and still my mind and allow life to come in, that not even come in, but allow myself to become aware of what already is, that what I've been searching for, I already have. We all already have what we're looking for. And in the process of searching, in some ways, of reaching out, of grabbing for more, it takes us away from what actually already is. We are life. There is no place that's more alive than wherever we are right in this instant. And so there's that sense of allowing ourselves to relax into what actually already is and recognize, oh, yeah, this is what I've always been looking for. What I've been looking for, I already always have.
Well, thank you so much, Bob. Is there anything else you'd like to end the hour with?
I guess one thing that, you know, in doing something like I've done, there's a sense that some people have of mythologizing, like somehow I'm heroic or special, and that's just not the case. I'm just a guy, you know, and I think that everybody's life is heroic if we live it fully. You know, people that are raising kids, that's just an amazing commitment and a heroic thing to be fully present to our lives however they are. And so, you know, it's not a matter of imagining ourselves to be off somewhere else in some remarkable circumstance. Because when I was living in solitude, that's where I was living. And so all the things that had bothered me in the city bothered me in solitude. We take ourselves with us. And so it's letting go of these mythologizing and that some people are special and some people heroic. And just letting go of that and coming into our own lives and reflecting on our own lives and living our own lives fully, wherever and however we are.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Bob.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Have a wonderful day.
You too.
Bye-bye. So that was Bob Cull. He is the author of Solitude, Seeking Wisdom in Extremes. And if you want to see some of the beautiful pictures he took from his year in solitude, it's Bob Cull, KULL.org. That's his website. And I'll also put a link up to his website on my site, spiritualshow.com. Coming up in just a few minutes is Scotty's Scenic Drive. So stick around for that here on CITR 101.9 FM. Coming up next week on Synchronicity, psychic medium Dana Smith will be on the show, so you're definitely going to want to tune in for that and call in live for some insights from Dana Smith. And coming this Tuesday, I will be hosting a new show online only. It's going to be on Blog Talk Radio. The name of the show is Namaste Radio, and I will be interviewing David Ord, and the theme of the month on Namaste Radio is going to be love. So definitely check that out on my website, spiritualshow.com. Again, coming up next is Scotty's Scenic Drive. I hope you have a wonderful weekend, a wonderful Valentine's Day. If you're in Vancouver, enjoy the events. Whether you are rooting for having the Olympics in Vancouver or you're totally against them, I hope that you are able to enjoy the spirit of the games and enjoy the energy in the city. So take care, have a wonderful weekend. And this is a song from Baird Hirsey and Prana from their album The Eternal Embrace. Take care.
Every Friday morning, 10 a.m. till noon, CITR.